you're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. And it lies between the pit of one's fears and the summit of one's knowledge. You are now traveling through a dimension of imagination. You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and if this is your first time listening, Anthology is one man's examination of the Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each podcast, I share my first impressions, analysis, and overall thoughts on Rod Serling's iconic series, one episode at a time. However, in this bonus episode review series, I'm reviewing Season 2 of Jordan Peele and Simon Kinberg's Twilight Zone reboot on CBS All Access, hosted by Jordan Peele. You can find more of Anthology as well as full episode archives at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, tweet me at @OVAnthologyPod, or send me an email at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. Finally, if you want to support the show and get access to exclusive content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and pledge a minimum of $1 per month for an exclusive RSS feed with content recorded specifically for Patreon supporters. In this episode, I did a Patreon special that was all about my feelings about the movie Keanu, which was directed by Peter Atencio, who also directed the episode of The Twilight Zone that I will be reviewing here momentarily. So today on the show, I'll be discussing The Who of You. It's the second episode, probably, of The Twilight Zone's second season, and it premiered with the rest of the season on June 25th, 2020, on CBS All Access. I say that it's probably the second episode because I got access to screeners ahead of the release, so I can't say for certain that this is going to be in the same order that the season is released in. However, on June 25th, all episodes are being released at once, so it's a moot point, like I said last time. So, yeah, so I'll just dive right in. Well, actually, I won't. I have some notes from last time. So, before I get to my review of The Who of You, I have some follow-up things that I thought of after I finished recording last week's episode about Meet in the Middle. So in that episode, I referenced how Gillian Jacobs' character has a Norman Bates moment at the end of the episode, where she kind of looks up to the camera, kind of similar to how Norman Bates does at the end of Psycho. What I didn't even consider or think about was that it was an homage to the Kubrick stare. So in a lot of Stanley Kubrick's movies, there is a moment where the character looks up at the camera with a deranged look on his or her face, and it's kind of the height of that character's psychosis or transformation into a monster or what have you. And I feel like that's probably what they were going for, instead of actually going for a Norman Bates kind of thing. But I found it cool because the episode, that was the first episode of the season, presumably, and it ends with a Kubrick reference, just like this, the comedian did the first episode of season one. The first episode of season one ends with a shot of the mural at the back of the comedy club that has Kumail's face in it, much like the end of The Shining. And I will talk more about Kubrick, later in this episode and later in the season, presumably, considering something that I saw in the trailer for the season that was released. And another note that I have is last time on the podcast, I referenced Drive because Kristen Lehman was in the show and made an appearance in that episode of The Twilight Zone. And I had no idea that I also went on a, not rant, but I got on a tangent last year when I was reviewing the episode Nightmare at 30,000 Feet about Drive, because the director of that episode, Greg Yutanis, had directed three episodes of Drive. So I'm sorry for the repetition and everything, but yeah, Drive was a show and I've now mentioned it twice on this podcast. So weird. Anyway. Another thing that I want to mention is that the screeners that I have kind of sound like the opening theme is slightly tweaked, and that the closing credits music is different too. Now when you get screeners, it's ahead of the release of the show. So they're not necessarily the complete version, or they're not the final version of it. So it's possible that they just haven't put the finishing touches on the theme music when they release the screeners to critics. So that's possible. So it could be a completely pointless observation on my part here, but I wanted to mention it because the closing credits music is different from the first season. In the first season, they had the closing credits music was the same music that was in the original series. And I kind of wonder if that is the final version of it for this season. I wonder if that's kind of a meta thing that they're doing since the end of last season, kind of hinted at the show taking its own, like following its own path through the Twilight Zone. So maybe they changed up the closing credits for that purpose, or maybe it's just not the final version of the episode and we'll have the normal music time, when the season is released. So who knows? Actually, you know, because you're listening to this after the release. So anyway, that's all the pre-show notes I have. So let's go into the Who of You. And plot summary, courtesy of CBS All Access, is struggling actor Harry risks everything to catch his big break, but an impulsive scheme takes a few turns no one saw coming. So I'm going to be spoiling the entire, like, right from the jump in this episode. So if you haven't watched it yet, please go watch it and come back and listen to my review. Otherwise, you will be spoiled. The Who of You stars Ethan Embry as Harry Pine. He's been working for a long time, Ethan Embry has. So I know him most of all from Can't Hardly Wait in like 99. I actually count it as one of my favorite movies of all time. It's just it's a one-night teen party movie. I love it. It has some of the best like music drops in a movie. The movie's use of the song Damn It by Blink-182 is one of the best needle drops in all of cinema, in my opinion. I say that with no snark or no snark or sarcasm of any kind. Like, it is legitimately, like, amazing. He was also in Grace and Frankie on Netflix and Sneaky Pete on Amazon Prime. And he was also in Blindspotting. And First Man, which I like to refer to as First Man, The Guest, and Cheap Thrills. All of those are good movies. I haven't seen Grace and Frankie or Sneaky Pete, the shows, but I've heard really great things about both of them, actually. And co-starring as Detective Reese is Daniel Sunjata. He is known for Rescue Me and Graceland, and he was also in The Dark Knight Rises. He was also in, an indie movie called Small Town Crime. With Octavia Spencer and John Hawks. That is a solid movie. It was on Netflix a while ago. It might still be on there. But I do want to mention it was directed by Ian and Esham Nelms, who I actually met and interviewed on Obsessive Viewer when they were in town for the Heartland Film Festival a few years ago for their movie Waffle Street. Super nice guys, like really just down to earth and they left a really strong impression on me that so I've been following their work ever since, and I'm a fan. So, Daniel Sunjata is also going to be in, CBS All Access's upcoming miniseries adaptation of The Stand, adapted by Josh Boone. He's going to be playing a character called Cobb, who I'm like 90%, 99% sure is not in the book. Over at Tower Junkies, my other podcast with Tiny, he and I are doing a review series of The Stand. We're doing the books. We're splitting the book up into three different podcast episodes for each part of the book. We're going to review the comic series and the first mini series from Mick Garris in the 90s. And then, of course, we're going to review the CBS All Access mini series as well. All of those are going to be released later in the year, whenever we have a firm date for when the Stand miniseries on CBS All Access is going to get released. But check that out at towerjunkiespod.com. But I'm pretty sure that Cobb is not in the book, because at this point, Tiny and I have already recorded parts one and two of our novel review part of the series, and Cobb has not come about in the book. So, yeah, so that'll be interesting to see. And then finally, Daniel Sunjata is also in the show Manifest, which I think is on ABC. And I bring that up. I haven't seen it, but I bring it up because I'm intrigued by the premise. It seems like something of a spiritual successor to Lost, which was one of my favorite shows of all time. The plot summary for Manifest is, after being presumed dead, passengers on board flight 828 return and discover the world has aged 5 years. As they reintegrate into society, they begin to experience guiding voices and visions, and soon a deeper mystery unfolds. I haven't watched it. I think I tried watching like the pilot episode, but I just couldn't really get into it. But yeah, he's in it, and maybe it's good. It just got renewed for season 3, so it apparently has an audience. So maybe I'll check it out sometime. Co-starring as Keith is Billy Porter. He's known for Pose, the movie Like a Boss, and he was in American Horror Story. I believe he's also a very active theater person and an activist for a lot of social causes and everything. Yeah. And then writer for this episode was Wynn Rosenfeld. He's a relatively prolific producer. Obviously, he produces The Twilight Zone. He also produced Lorena on Amazon Prime, Black Klansman, The Last OG, and the upcoming Candyman remake. And that is actually his only other writing credit. He's one of the credited screenwriters for Nia DaCosta's upcoming Candyman movie, so that's pretty cool. And then director for this episode was Peter Atencio. He directed, is that right? He directed 54 episodes of Key and Peele. Holy crap, that's incredible. He also directed 3 episodes of The Last Man on Earth, a show which also featured Mel Rodriguez, who appears in this episode of The Twilight Zone. And he also directed 4 episodes of Whiskey Cavalier, the short-lived cop show with Lauren Cohan and I can't remember the guy's name. He was in Scream 3. But anyway, and he also directed Keanu from 2016 with Key and Peele. I talked about it in the Patreon selection, so if you want to hear my thoughts on it, either go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and check that out, or just dig in the Obsessive Viewer archives and find our episode where we reviewed it. So, that's the talent rundown. I'm going to go into my thoughts about The Who of You. Once again, I'm going to be spoiling it from the outset, so this is your final warning. Yeah, I'm going to be spoiling The Who of You. So, my initial thoughts, the first time I watched it, I've watched it about 4 or 5 times at this point. The first thought that I had after finishing it the first time was a body swap episode. Like, that was awesome. I was super into it. That was pretty fun, high energy. It was reminiscent of The Four of Us Are Dying from the original series' first season. And, in the grand scheme of things in this iteration of The Twilight Zone, this episode was much more gimmick focused than anything. And that sounds like a slight against it, but I actually liked it for that. It kind of had this feel to it that felt like it was more at home in the 2002 Twilight Zone show, which again feels like a slight against it, but it actually worked pretty well. I was kind of taken with this episode. So without further ado, I'll go into my full review of The Who of You. So I have a fun theory based on the first and last shot of the episode. So we see that there's a camcorder that's taping Harry as he's at his audition. And my theory is that since that camera at the end, when Jordan Peele takes the tape out, it's a Whipple camera. And presumably it's the same camera as Replay. I just assume that it is. My theory is, what if the camera is what causes the body swapping? Like that's just what causes it, just because it's a supernatural prop in the Twilight Zone. Neither here nor there. It's a fun theory that I had for it. But, so we get our introduction to Harry. He is about to read for a part in a show. He mentions that his beard, he can shave it off if he gets the job. And he references that he grew it between roles. So that tells us that he hasn't had a role in a while, obviously, because he has a very, very large beard, which I mean, I have a little bit of beard envy on that because I cannot grow a beard. That is the one thing I've learned from this, pandemic. I cannot grow a full beard and it is a bummer. So clearly Harry hasn't had a role in a while. And I love the impersonal nature of the audition. I thought that that was well done and well constructed. It was good cinematography. He's in this dark room with lights that are like flashing in front of him or that are trained on him. He can't see anyone that he's talking to. And yeah, he's just lit by the lights and the monitors and everything else is dark. I really appreciated that. And I enjoyed that element of the episode. And the show takes that a step further by having the impersonal nature of the audition expanded to the impersonal interaction between Harry and the casting people. So when Harry tries to connect with them, when he recognizes a voice and says, "Oh, hey, John, you cast me in Macbeth a while ago," he's shot down immediately. Like, John doesn't remember him. John is kind of polite, but it's clear, like, he's just like, "All right, just get on with your audition, man." But then Harry asks, like, "Hey, I want to read for the lead role." And then they get just outright angry. Like, "Oh, we called you for this role. Like, you're not going to read for the lead role in the show." So all in all, it's a bad audition. And we get back to the apartment where he and his girlfriend Morena lives. And we see, based on the newspaper clippings and everything, that Morena is an up-and-coming actress and she's successful. And this is seeding the idea of Harry being in this insecure, struggling actor who's dealing with his partner being more successful and everything. And I'm glad that there's not any outwardly character defect to him or problem for him to overcome. It's just plain and simple that Harry is a self-involved kind of loner character who only sees value within himself in how he can spend money or make money or use money or use people even. He's a very self-involved character. And something that I like about their interaction, because they have a very lengthy interaction in this opening scene. He talks about how the show he auditioned for how it sucks. Like, he says that he doesn't know how he's, or why he should be debasing himself for roles like that. And Morena is trying to comfort him and saying, like, "Well, it is very popular." I don't know if that's necessarily her comforting him, but she's kind of saying, like, "Well, you know, it's a big opportunity." And that's when he says that the show sucks. And what I like about this, it tells us about his character pretty succinctly and clearly. He's deflecting his failure at the audition by downplaying what the role would have done for him, his career, and his relationship. So he is saying that, "Well, it's a crappy show anyway. I'm above it." And it's just, that is his character flaw in one scene, like right there. He thinks that he is above everything and he only wants to self, like, he only lives in his selfishness with his desires and wants and needs and everything. He lacks empathy, as Keith tells him later in the episode. So this leads to, the more of an argument. So as they're arguing about the shows, that's when the power suddenly goes out. And I thought this was a fun misdirect, because when the power goes out, I thought, okay, this is where we're getting into the Twilight Zone element of it. Like, this is something with the power. Something's going to happen with them and the power or something. And that's even further, that kind of misdirect is even furthered, because when she goes to the window and sees that everyone else has power, she says she's going to call the landlord, Harry is just standing perfectly still, like elegy still. And I thought that that was going to lead to the Twilight Zone element of the episode. But again, that was a fun misdirect. I thought it was just clever that it was just an extension of their argument, because he says when she's calling the landlord, he's like, "I didn't pay the power bill." And that leads to a deeper argument. Like, the conversation that they have goes from kind of comforting disappointment to argument over his, like, resistance to, like, his entitlement, essentially, and insecurities, to her wanting to break up with him. Like, it's very much escalated throughout this scene. And I like that, like, he cuts her off when she says, "You can't expect things to be," and I think the kind of you can infer that the rest of that is like to be handed to you or something, because she talks about how she goes on to talk about how relationships need work and everything needs work. And it's just, it's really good writing for the relationship, I thought. So he goes up to her and he like kind of kneels down in front of her while she's on the couch. And he says, I know that things aren't the way that they should be right now, but I'm working on it. Give me time. I have a plan. And her response to that is like the most genuine, like, this is a relationship in trouble moment. When she says, you're going to let me in on your plan, because it would be nice to feel like we're working on a solution together. And that kind of pinpoints the problem with their relationship and their dynamic and everything. He is very much in his own world, and he wants to do things in his own way. He's unwilling to have he's cohabitating with his girlfriend, he doesn't want to delegate like the issues that he's facing with her. He doesn't want to share a life with her. He's just in a relationship. So it's pretty an interesting dynamic from the outset, and it makes the ending very complex and thought-provoking, because obviously it ends with him in her lover's body without knowing that he is him. I'll get to that at the end of this review, of course. So Miranda tells him that it isn't about money, it's about work. She says that jobs need work and relationships need work. And she just flat out tells him, you act like you're entitled to money and people and basically everything else. And so he deflects, because that's kind of his thing, and like starts to tell her that she's being dramatic. And then she says, and I love this line, she says, don't say dramatic with that antiquated gaslighting shtick. It's really indicative of the nature of their relationship. It goes a long way into introducing us to their dynamic and everything. And then she goes on to say that she's tired of living with a ghost who can't be happy for my success, which, man, that is like a slap in the face. Like, that is such an elegant way to just tell someone that they're selfish and a dick. And it's interesting, because when he was telling her that he has a plan, like in that moment when he's kneeling down and he's telling her that he has a plan and everything, I believed him. Like, I believed that sincerity. I thought that was such a sincere thing. And then her side of the argument just really plays out how one-sided their relationship seems to be, and how his insecurities and his ego is what's holding him and that relationship back. I thought that was just a really great piece of writing to really draw us into this very dysfunctional and fading relationship dynamic. That is kind of the driving force, I would say, of this episode of The Twilight Zone. And as I said before, it kind of escalates. It slowly escalates. And I think that that's something that, is really well done in this episode, is that this, or at least in this scene, it escalates further. So he mentions that, or he says, do you even love me anymore? And that just gets right to the heart of the thing. And it also seems passive aggressive or slightly manipulative because she had said, like, don't do that gaslighting thing. And then he's asking this, like, very kind of hurt puppy dog question. Do you even love me anymore? And I want to mention, I love that, like, light guitar music that's playing in the score here. I actually thought for a second that this scene seemed, at first it kind of seemed kind of peculiar to me. Like, I thought for a second that we were going to get a kind of a World of Difference kind of reveal, like in Blurry Man, where this would be revealed to be a movie or TV show within the show. And I'm glad it wasn't, because like I said, it would be like Blurry Man, and they've already done that. It would be redundant at this point. So her response to that is, look, I think we need to talk. And obviously this is the talk of breaking up and everything. And he immediately dodges the conversation, knowing that it's a breakup, presumably. And he just goes into the next room, where he gets the gun and bag from the kind of hamper thing. And And honestly, this is my fault. It took me a little while to realize he got a gun from the room. Like, I was a little bit slow on the uptake there. And then, when I realized it, when it clicked with me, I was like, oh, okay, wow, okay, this is the way that the episode's gonna go. Okay, I'm on board. So he leaves the apartment saying, I'm gonna go get the power turned back on. I'm going to my manager's to pick up a check. And this next line confirms that he still doesn't get it. It's not about money. And he's avoiding the bigger problem of poor communication and just general unhappiness in the relationship. And he just doesn't hear her. All of her concerns fall on deaf ears. Even this last line where she says it's not just about checks. He just leaves without following up on that. And, at that point, she just sounds done with him. Just completely done. And we'll find out later more about that. So we get outside, and the first thing we see is this very cool top-down overhead shot of the city. And I just think that that is just spectacular and something I wasn't really expecting out of the show. It shows there are lots of people in the city and that Harry is just one small, relatively insignificant person in it. And during this scene, as it transitions to him walking down the sidewalk and walking to the bank, there's this really tense music that's playing in the soundtrack. Very good music this season, by the way. I really think that Marco Beltrami and, the other person who is composing, for the show, have really stepped it up. I'm really enjoying the music this season. But yeah, here the track is pretty intense and it's got this kind of ticking clock quality that's a pretty heavy turn from the kind of light guitar riff that's playing during the relationship conversation and dissolvement scene earlier. So I like the variety that's at play here. And so, okay, so Harry is outside of the bank and he's psyching himself up. And I love this scene. I love this scene because he just says, okay, I can do this. I can do this. I went to Juilliard. I can do this. it's really fantastic. It kind of shows just how out of his element he is and how completely ill prepared he is for what he's about to do. But the robbery itself is pretty intense. As he's walking through the bank, he sees the security guard who has this banana in his hand that's kind of playing with it kind of like a gun. That was kind of funny, kind of weird, shows how, I mean, I was a security guard for like 10 years, so that's pretty accurate. The guard sees him, so he goes up to the counter and he pulls out the gun and he's just intense. Like, Ethan Embry's intensity in this scene is really strong and really good, but at the same time, it's also believable that he doesn't want to hurt anybody. So I really like that line that's towed in this moment of the robbery. So the guard sees him and kind of calls attention to Jill, the bank teller, and is like, hey, is everything okay? And so Harry turns around and reveals himself as a robber. And so he points the gun all around erratically and he yells at everyone to get down. And like I said, he has this intensity, but also this, it's believable that he doesn't necessarily want to hurt anyone. Because he says, stay calm. The way that he says, stay calm and we'll all go home tonight is pretty indicative of that. I like that. So he makes eye contact with Jill, to get the bag from her, and the camera rushes in on their faces, their pupils dilate, the soundtrack booms, the music swells, and I have in my notes, just all caps, Freaky Friday ep. I thought that was such a cool reveal of the concept of the episode and what was to come. It floored me, because I had no idea that this was the way that the episode was going to go. And honestly, I was, at this point in the episode, I was getting a little restless that the episode hadn't revealed itself yet. Kind of like The Comedian, this story takes a while to get into the Twilight Zone. At this episode, it's 7 minutes into the episode before the body swap happens. And that's interesting to me. Like, to go back to The Comedian in last season, it takes about 9 minutes for The Comedian to reveal that Twilight Zone element to it. And, that episode is also 9 minutes longer at 55 minutes than this episode, which is about 46. So I find that interesting because, there's more time to set up the characters in this episode than other episodes. So there's this look of confusion between Jill and Harry when they swap bodies. Harry says, Harry as Jill says, "Give me the bag. Oh my God." And then Jill as Harry drops the gun, revealing that it's a toy gun, which I thought was interesting because it is showing how ill-equipped he is for this robbery that he's committing. And it also has the sense, it gives me the sense that the episode is trying to make him less dangerous or make him more relatable to an extent. Like, they're not taking him too far into, like, irredeemable territory. Which is interesting given the ending of the episode, but I'll get to that later. And then she looks up at Jill, who is Harry. This is going to be fun to, this is going to be fun to make sense of, but she says in Harry's body, that's me," and then faints. And I just like that. I like how this episode reveals itself, and I like that This is the introduction to everything. And Harry, as Jill, leaves with the bag, where we see, we hear police sirens, and then the security guards converge on the passed out Jill in Harry's body. And that's when we get the opening narration from Jordan Peele. And I'm going to go ahead and play that here.
Meet Harry Pine. Up until now, he's failed to realize that he's not the center of the world. But, as you can see, he's also not entirely himself at the moment. Harry's mind is an uninvited guest in an unfamiliar body. He's about to go on a journey of self-discovery, the kind that's only possible here in the Twilight Zone.
And I really like this opening narration, despite the recurrence of the "meet Harry Pine" kind of formula. It's whatever, it's fine. But I like the tone of it because it's less ominous and it's more fun. Like, Jordan Peele has this kind of playful smirk on his face when he's giving the narration, and it just gives this sense of being just much more laid back than the other episodes in tone, and it really makes us anticipate a more fun and supernatural situation driven episode, which is something that this iteration of the Twilight Zone hasn't really done. It's all been character or social dynamic focused, and this is an interesting change up for the show. And the part of the narration that I love the most is just the phrasing of the sentence, "Harry's mind is an uninvited guest in an unfamiliar body." I don't know. I love the brevity of that and how just succinct and strong it is. And it's just very colorful writing and phrasing. So after the opening credits, we get the introduction of Detective Reese, and he's pretty charismatic from the jump. He walks in and he asks the security guard, "Oh, he's been unconscious this whole time," and then he looks at him and he says, "You knock him out with that banana," and I don't know, it just shows that he's kind of likable and amiable. And there's a look of recognition when he sees that it's Harry Pine, like when he pulls the scarf down. And I'd really be interested in this episode, in like an alternate version of this episode that's told specifically from Reese's point of view, which we get a lot of his perspective throughout the episode, but it would be really interesting to see how this day went for him. And spoiler alert, by the end, not well. So then we get a scene where Jill, with Harry in her mind, runs into her coworker Belinda, and I love this altercation that takes place. So as Belinda is frantically and hysterically talking to Jill about what happened, there's this echoey way that the soundtrack shifts. And I thought that was a nice effect on the soundtrack to show that, you know, Harry is not prepared to fake a conversation with a stranger in the body of someone that she knows very well. And I love the line where Jill says that the robber was probably tripping balls. And I like that extra touch of Harry saying lines that clearly wouldn't come from the people whose bodies he is occupying. It's really fun. It's a really fun kind of play with the words there. And so I do want to mention that Jill's confusion and awkwardness is played really well in this episode. And the actress playing Belinda also does a good job. Like, her insistence that Jill sits down and takes care of herself says a lot about how close they are as coworkers, I think. And it kind of leads to the end of their interactions being pretty, pretty intense and interesting. But then we get a cut back over to Reese in the lobby, who takes a call from his girlfriend, which of course we end up knowing is Morena, who he's having an affair with. And these are a little too, like, this happens a few times throughout the episode. And honestly, I kind of wrestled with it. Like, these are a little too open-ended and not very compelling to me. Like, it really only serves to establish that Reese has a girlfriend and that the girlfriend is sort of clingy or is having some kind of situation occur where she needs his attention, but he is busy with work. And it's only there to set up the twist at the end, which is fine, but I wish there was something more to it. Like, it would have been better for me, I think, if Reese and Morena were having some kind of problem, and that's what the phone calls were alluding to. But at the same time, that would be just an echo of Morena and Harry's situation from early in the episode. And also, Morena in this scenario wants to talk to Reese, presumably because she just had a fight with Harry and it's pretty much over. And the ending brings all this together fine enough. Like, that's fine. It's okay how it ends up. But even then, in that situation, it's more about Harry's growth or lack thereof than anything else. It's not necessarily about Peter Reese and Morena. It's about Harry and Morena. So I don't know. It's fine in the grand scheme of things. I just kind of wish that there was a little bit more there, for it. So then we get back to Jill and Belinda, who are interrupted by Luntz, played by Mel Rodriguez. And I love that the interaction between Jill and Belinda has just escalated beyond control. Like, they're arguing. Jill is being very, very aggressive. She yells at her to shut up, bitch. And I thought that was really interesting, given that, you know, obviously these are coworkers and Jill is not herself. And it's just, you can sense how out of character it is for her to be that vulgar and aggressive toward Belinda. And I can't help but just imagine Belinda's perspective. Like I said, her coworker is stealing from the bank and fighting her over it and is literally a completely different person. And I just, the confusion of that is just really fascinating to me as an insight into the character and everything. And then when she swaps out and when Harry jumps over into Luntz's body and Jill returns to hers, I love that. Like, I think that's great for Jill's character. Like, her confusion upon returning to her body is just played very well. And that kind of final scene between her and Belinda is really funny. Like, she's so confused and she's like, what are you talking? I was at your wedding. Like, we're close. I love that. And really, that at that point, that's when we learn more about the concept of the episode, that he is jumping into people's bodies, and then the people whose bodies he's jumping into are going into his body, and then the person he's jumping out of at the same time is returning to his body, to his or her body. And it's just, it's almost complex to an extent, but it provides a ripple effect that really, really allows this episode to go to some fun places with the plot and with the characters that Harry's inhabiting throughout it. Really, I just love the concept of this episode. And again, the sound effect and the way that the camera zooms in on the faces when the swap happens, and the way that the pupils dilate and everything is just a really nice touch. It shows how just invasive and intense this action is and how confusing it is as well. So Harry is now in Luntz's body. And I just want to say, first of all, Mel Rodriguez is amazing in this episode. He does a fantastic job. I'll talk about it as we move along in the episode, but, Harry jumps into Luntz, and again, it just adds complexity to the episode. It shows whoever he jumps into goes into his body, and whoever he jumps out of returns to their own. I already covered that, but just to reiterate it. And I love the kind of the scene before the act break where Luntz in Harry's body tells Reese that he's right there. And the confusion is so cool. And like Ethan Embry is just nailing this performance so well. The fluidity of him going from character to character is really kind of akin to, McAvoy's performance in Split. Like, that's a very impressive performance as well. But Ethan Embry seems to be having just a blast playing this role. And he does a really great kind of subtle affectation on his voice when he is in these different characters. Like when he is, when Luntz is in his body, like he does this, he does like a soft imitation of Mel Rodriguez to an extent, but it's more tonal than anything. It's impressive because it's not like he's trying to do an impression of Mel Rodriguez, but he's getting this soft, tone. Throughout, like through his vocal cords while still being just a natural, voice, if that makes sense. So Luntz comes out of the bank and there's another cool overhead shot of, the circle of the town, transitioning into a clock, but I'll get to that in a second because I just realized I jumped ahead. So Luntz is walking, through this town square, town circle, place, and, through the town center. And the song, "I've Got You Under My Skin" by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons is playing. And this scene was a little confusing, like, Luntz walking through the town square. So, Harry doesn't know how to, I like the physical performance that Mel Rodriguez brings to this, because in his mind, Harry doesn't understand or doesn't know how to manage this new body. So his gait is awkward as hell, and he's awkwardly reassuring people around him, like the girls sitting next to the steps. He's like, "Oh, everything's okay," and they kind of laugh at him. And then there's a guy behind him that's making fun of him, and that felt kind of out of place. Like, I couldn't really hear what else it was. Like what it was, like what the deal was. I don't know what the deal was. It just kind of seemed like the guy was harassing him, and then, Luntz didn't acknowledge him, but that didn't really make much sense for me. So that was a little confusing. But then we get to the cool overhead shot. It's another top down view, and I love how that transitions into the circle. Transitions into the clock in the apartment. Because it's not just a rehash of that top-down city shot. It adds to that visual style. And I really like the freshness that it provides there. So in the apartment, Morena is reading Comedy of Errors. In my notes I have, is reading Comedy of Errors by Billy Shakes. Shakespeare. So her phone is laying on a stack of scripts. And I thought that was a nice kind of subtle touch to show her success. So it's kind of adds to those, newspaper clippings that are on the wall in the opening, one of the opening scenes of the episode. So Harry calls her as Luntz, or in Luntz's body, and she doesn't believe him, obviously. Like, why would she believe that this strange voice is her boyfriend? And I really like Mel Rodriguez's performance as Harry, because he's trying to reassure her and also working to make himself sound like Harry. Like, it is a very deliberate and careful conversation that he's having, or careful line reading that he's doing, because Harry in his body is trying to come across as himself, but he can't because he is in a completely different body with a completely different, like, makeup of vocal cords and muscles and everything. Like, he's a completely different person. So she hangs up on him, and then he calls her back. But I want to mention that I really like the shot of him calling her back. It's shot from across the street at kind of an angle on the phone booth or the bus stop or wherever he was in. So that's dead on. So it's kind of catty corner from him. And I just love the set design of this one shot, really. The leaves are all over the ground. There are older car models that are parked on either side of the street, and the Four Seasons song, is still playing in the scene. And it's a song from 1966. So it kind of gives this vintage feel to it. This almost like 60s era and everything, which is where the original Twilight Zone obviously lived. And I kind of like that as just this subtle and just visual throwback to the era in which the Twilight Zone existed. I don't know if that's the intention, but I really appreciated that and thought it was a cool visual moment for that episode. So then we get back to the police station, and these parts of the episode are pretty decent police procedural. A cop comes in and breaks down the events breaks down Harry's record to Reese and says that there's no priors. He's an actor, but hasn't worked much. He had a national commercial about 10 years ago, but that's about it. And Reese doesn't know what to make of it at this moment. And he says, "I doubt you'll find much. Seems like a nobody." And I like this quick shot of him kind of eyeing up, the other officer. Like, Reese is kind of like glancing over at the officer and trying to read his face to see if there's any tell that shows that, like, oh, this cop is on to Reese and his connection to Harry. So the cop informs Reese that they can't find Luntz, and Reese doesn't really buy it. Even though the video from the bank shows that Luntz took the money and left. And the cop asks, "Do you think they were in on it?" And Reese says, "Does that sound like something Luntz would do? How long have we known him?" And the cop says, "It does seem out of character, but who really knows anybody?" And this offhanded comment is met with some hostility from Reese. Like, Reese is kind of a little impatient with him and says, like, "Oh, that's a really deep thought. Why don't you go find him," or whatever. And I kind of wondered, is Reese's response out of guilt or concern that the other officer knows his secret? Or is it just that, you know, he's not really one for profound thought or anything? I don't know. So then we get a scene of Harry as Luntz rehearsing in the mirror. He's trying to get a good voice down for his own voice, so that he can convince Mirena that he is himself. And this is a very fun scene because he turns it into an audition as a cop, doing some like kind of bland, police dialogue and everything. And this is dumb, but in my notes I have, "When in costume, do as the costume do." But it also shows how self-obsessed Harry is. Like, he's trying to get to a point where he can convince Mirena that he's Harry, and, you know, presumably salvage the relationship and everything, but he can't help himself. He wants to play in Luntz's body and be self-serving. He wants to use it to elevate his perceived failings that he has about himself. And also, I just want to mention that this is another scene this season involving a character in a mirror and a character in a bathroom. Of course, the use of mirrors is a pretty big staple of the original Twilight Zone series. And then it ends in a bit of comic relief where a guy knocks on the door and is like, "Hey, get out of there," or "finish up quick," or whatever. And so Harry, as Luntz, just says, "Occupied." And this is back-to-back episodes, assuming that this is going to be episode 2, back-to-back episodes with awkward bathroom encounters and awkward bathroom interactions, because in Meet in the Middle, we had that scene where where Jimmy Simpson yells, "Get out," just as the guy is entering the bathroom. And in my notes, this is half joking, but I kind of wonder if this is this season's 10-15 recurring Easter egg thing. How ridiculous would that be? Like, every episode has a scene of someone in the bathroom that ends in an awkward encounter. Yeah. So Reese enters the interrogation room where Harry/Luntz is being held. And Reese has this demeanor to him that kind of reminds me of a combination of The Rock and Keegan-Michael Key's part in the cat poster sketch from Key and Peele. I don't know. It's a weird observation and everything, but Reese carries himself well as a detective, and he kind of has this friendliness to him, but he's still like an authority figure, and I kind of appreciated that performance from Daniel Sunjata. So here Luntz is trying to convince Reese that he's Luntz and not Harry. And again, Ethan Embry just nails the scene. He talks about the kids, his wife, how he got hammered at last year's Christmas party, and Reese had to drive him home. And none of this is working because Reese is like, okay, you've done your research and everything. And Luntz tells he has like a wild card. He's like, okay, I know your secret. But I love how careful the character is before he tells Reese he knows the secret. Like, he's very delicate with it. He does a lot of preamble for it and talks about how like he would never do this under any other circumstance and everything. And as soon as he tells him that he knows the secret, Reese turns off the recorder. And as good as that scene was and how interesting as it was, I wish there was more seeding of this. We don't get that kind of payoff, or we don't get his real reaction or anything. But the payoff is at the very end of the episode. And while I don't know, it's kind of conflicted. I'm kind of conflicted because while I do wish that there was more seeding of this kind of subplot and everything in this reveal, on the other hand, they don't press it too hard. So the reveal at the end is still a surprise. Like, I was genuinely surprised and I enjoyed it, but I kind of felt like it took a minute after I first saw this episode where I was just like, oh, yeah, okay, well, Luntz knows his secret. That's the secret he was referring to. Like, it didn't even connect with me until after I finished the episode and was thinking about it and everything. So we switch from the interrogation room to a coffee shop where I've Got You Under My Skin is playing again. I don't know if it was the same version. I don't think it was. It kind of felt like a lobby version of it. Not Muzak, but like, it kind of felt like an altered version of it. I don't know what version it was though. So Harry orders like a pastry or something, and he avoids eye contact. He's very nervous and everything. He gives the name Morena, which I thought was kind of weird too. Just kind of showing that he, you know, is thinking about her and everything. Like, I don't know. So then the barista is like, oh, hey, do you want me to get any for your friends too? Anything for your friends too? And we see like three cops that are strolling in and walking in. So that's when Harry jumps into the barista. And this is after he throws the bag of money across the counter. And then the barista with Harry inside him, bolts and everything, which, yeah, I don't know. It could be. Like, I was thinking, like, okay, well, Harry should have just played it cool at that moment. Like, okay, Luntz is going to get taken away and everything, and, you know, he's free to leave. But then again, also, Harry is in a position where the adrenaline is probably still very much, like, at a red line in his body, so he needed to bolt and everything. And I think that, I wasn't really sure, but I think that the barista has some kind of foot injury or like a boot on, to heal a foot injury. And that's why he starts looking for other people to jump into, also to lose the cops. So he passes by like an old lady and he's like, no, that isn't going to work. And then he is running toward a jogger who has like his outfit is so just out there and awkward, but so he jumps into the jogger, and then we see the jogger running as the barista is just kind of a blank expression. First of all, when the jogger is running with the bag and everything, with Harry inside him and everything, he has this just goofy look on his face. I don't know. It was kind of funny to me. So the barista gets tackled, and then he's just like, oh, what the hell, and everything. So, I mean, it's a good, like, brief action set piece or action scene for the episode that I appreciated. It's brief, and it doesn't outstay its welcome by any stretch. And so after that, we get a scene of the police station where Reese is talking to Jill and showing the surveillance footage of her leaving with the bag. And she doesn't understand. She's, I love this scene. Like, there are little bits of comedy in this episode that I think go a long way and really make it come together in a fun way. Because she says, maybe he drugged her or hypnotized her. And then she says, charge him with criminal hypnosis. And I don't know, just the, the absurdity of that kind of got to me. I got a kick out of that line. I really enjoyed that. So the cop is updating Reese again, tells him that they got, Luntz and everything, but they don't have the bag. The barista got the bag, but then left, and, they don't have the bag. They didn't recover the money. So at this moment, they go back into the interrogation room, and again, like, what a great, like, platform for Ethan Embry to just do, like, really just dive into no pun intended, dive into these characters. He is, like, as the jogger, John, he is flipping out inside Harry's mind. And the physicality that Ethan Embry is bringing to this moment and the just hectic nature of it, his screaming and yelling at the police, is just spot on. It's perfect. I really enjoyed this moment and everything. So that's when, and like when Reese comes in and says something about like, oh, hey, Harry or whatever. And then he's like, oh, I'm sorry, Luntz. He says that in just this very, very derisive way that I really appreciated. And then he realizes like, oh crap, it's another person. And he's like, I'm a jogger or my name's John. And then I love that. So then we switch back to, Harry in John's body, and he has changed his outfit. Thank God. And he's continuing to practice telling Mirena and talking to Mirena and trying to get a good voice down for him. And he's prepping for a performance. But then he spots a police car at the corner that causes him to go into this, for lack of a better word, psychic store. So he was standing outside of the psychic shop, and a woman passes by and says, oh, he's a fraud, he just wants your money. And then he sees the car and then goes in. But I want to mention, like, there's not many Easter eggs in either of these episodes that I've reviewed so far, that I've seen. So I was like, I paused it and I tried to look for Easter eggs and stuff, but there was nothing. I do want to mention that it was weird. Like, the sign outside of the shop says prescriptions, and I'm like, prescriptions for what? Like, I don't know what a psychic can write a prescription for or whatever. But anyway. So, Harry, as John, goes into the store or the shop, and we hear Keith, his lines where he's saying, you're not who you appear to be. I see a man who's pretending to be someone he's not or something he's not. Do you know who you are? And I love how these vague, mystic words apply directly to Harry and his situation. And Billy Porter, as Keith, is phenomenal in this episode. He does a great job of doing this just mystic kind of fraud, really, but he sells it really well. And Harry asks, so Harry sits down at the table and asks if he has psychic client confidentiality, which I appreciate. I thought that was kind of funny. Kind of like the, charge him with, criminal hypnosis or whatever. I thought that was really funny. And I like that Keith, like, he's like, you're not my client yet, and then slides the tray over. It feels like a combination of like a religious confessional and tithing, that's a different thing. Tithing, I think, where they, give money to the church, and pass around the collection plate. It felt like that. And like, this is just a really warped kind of religious confessional scenario that's happening. So Harry pays and he starts to come clean and tell Keith what's up. He's like, I robbed a bank this morning. And I like Billy Porter's reaction to that and his performance in that. He says like, oh really? Why? He's trying to gauge like what has just walked into his shop. And Harry doesn't really know. He's like, I don't know how to answer that. To get money, I don't know. And then Harry kind of confides in him. He talks about how he thinks his girlfriend is going to leave, and he kind of says that he thinks she may be cheating on him. And this little detail is in the midst of just a character development dialogue. So it flies under the radar and I like it. Like, it seeds that idea in the episode, but we don't really give it a second thought because he goes on to talk about how his career is a dumpster fire and he can't afford the house or the apartment that they live in. And again, Harry can only view success and happiness through the prism of his own selfish feelings. And all of his insecurities and issues are born from him and him alone. So this is just doubling down on that and making it a very, intrinsically narcissistic kind of character trait for Harry. And I like that we have this scene, and it doesn't feel redundant at all. It's just doubling down. It's just really strengthening our view of the character, even after this really high concept body swapping stuff has taken place. And then he says, she says it isn't about money. And first of all, I'm glad that he heard it or was listening at least to that. And I love Keith's response. He says, but like, and he does it very slowly, but you robbed a bank. Just very, like, not even condescending. He's just trying to understand who this person is. So at this point, Harry sees the teddy bear through the skylight and gets distracted looking at it. First, I think the plane overhead kind of piques his interest, and he looks and he sees the bear through the window. And like, I appreciate the distraction and how he focuses on it and everything. But on the other hand, there's not much reason for him to focus on that detail in that moment. Like, the bear is of no importance. The positioning of that window is of no importance in that moment. Unless he's already planning to stash the money in the psychic's shop and then break into that apartment and come down and get it. But those are like four steps ahead of where he could be at that moment. I don't know. So, and also, I thought when he saw the teddy bear, I really thought that this was going to end with him accidentally jumping into the bear by making eye contact with the bear. And I'm really glad they didn't do that. I'm really glad they didn't go that route, because it would have been way too much like Black Mirror, specifically the episode Black Museum. So I'm glad that they didn't go that route, but I would be lying if I said that I didn't really think that that was a possibility for this episode. And I'm glad, like I said, I'm glad they didn't do it, because it would have made no sense whatsoever. But then, on the other hand, it would have been really eerie to have him jump into this bear and then see, like, the body, or see his body just crumple and have, like, nothing, like, be completely brain dead. That would have been really just, again, Black Mirror-y, but it would have been really interesting and dark. So at this, and then Keith kind of is like, hey, are you still with me? And then he brings his attention back, and here Keith talks to him about empathy. And this is a very, very, very important scene. He says, from in my experience, when people think things are about money, they are generally about something else. And like, this is the episode's message and moral. And he goes on to say, they're usually about how much empathy you have. And then he asks, are you being generous with your empathy? And instead of really confronting that character flaw, Harry tells Keith about the jumping and the swapping, the body swapping. And Keith is receptive to it. He asks, like, why the jogger? And then Harry says, I don't know, I needed an escape. And obviously the concept of escape is going to be an overarching theme throughout the season, just based on the promotional material that's been released about the season. Like, the tagline for the season is escape. And I kind of like how it's incorporated here. So Harry says, but I don't know, I kind of like being this guy. And I love that at that moment, that's when Keith has, like, zeroed in on the badness within Harry. And his just silent acting is just, it's conveys so much, because he is clearly concerned with where the jogger is. And he asks him, like, where's this man then? Where's his mind? And I love just the casualness of Harry's response, where he says, I never really thought about it. And of course he didn't, because he's selfish. He's self-serving. He is only in, he is only viewing the world through the prism of his own personal happiness without regard to other people's thoughts or feelings. And that's just a really great piece of characterization in that moment. And then we get a temporary swap with Keith grabbing Harry, and it's like, well, let's see where he is. And he forces a swap. And he does it, I don't think, not really to test the theory of it. I think that he believes what's happening, but I think he does it to get more insight into what's happening, like to find out more information. So, and that's also because he's an empathetic person. Like, he wants to know where this jogger is, because clearly the guy that is inhabiting the jogger's body, doesn't care one bit. And so then we get Keith in Harry in the police station, and Ethan Embry is once again just awesome in this. Like, he has this suave kind of thing that he does when he does Keith, as a character. And it's just very kind of playful and kind of, just slow and calculating to an extent. So Reese asks him where he just was. And at this point, it's hard to tell how much Reese buys into all of this. Like, I like that they're out of the interrogation room, though. And I feel like that shows that Reese is at least accepting of Harry's belief in what's happening. Like, he may still think that he's just kind of, a head case at this point. But he's taken him into a more comfortable place. And I kind of thought maybe he also feels guilty at this point. That could be a total reach, though, because he knows who Harry is. We got that from the look of recognition at the opening scene where he sees Harry's unconscious body. And maybe he feels guilty with having him, or maybe he feels unsafe. I don't know. But again, that could be a total stretch. I don't know. In this moment with Keith inhabiting Harry's body, I wish that there was a scene with Harry and John in the psychic shop during this scene. I just think that would have been a really interesting, interaction to see in the episode. Although them not having that interaction in this episode, it didn't detract from it or anything. I'd be interested to see if there's like a deleted scene or something. Regardless of whether or not Reese buys into it or anything, when Keith leaves Harry's body and is replaced by John, he gets more information. Reese gets more information from him. So he's established that it's Cherry Street and that there's some kind of psychic shop that there. So Harry, just grabs John or grabs, I'm sorry, Reese grabs John and is like, okay, well, congratulations. Your body just became a human GPS. And I don't know, just those like lines, those seem like such, they seem like they're crafted with the intention of being like cop, detective, procedural scenes and lines of dialogue from those types of shows and everything. And I appreciate it for that, because I think that they land really well. And I think that that is due in large part, to Daniel Sunjata's performance as Reese. I think he just nails this role so, so hard. And I also want to mention that before the swap back to John, Keith, as Harry, asks if Reese has a problem dealing with stress, noting the origami crane and everything. And I like the line where he's like, "No, I have a problem dealing with assholes." Yeah, and I don't know if the idea of him dealing with stress is indicative of the fact that he's engaging in an affair with someone or not. I don't know. That could also be a reach as well. So when they swap back and when Keith leaves the scene and is replaced by John, I love once again Ethan Embry's performance where he is John and he's pleading. Like, his pleas in the police station are great when he comes back into Harry's body. So then we get back into the psychic shop where Harry is inhabiting John's body again, and he gets information from Keith. Like, he's asking where was he, and he says police station with a hot daddy cute suit. I thought that was pretty funny. So Keith confides at this moment. This is another pivotal moment of the episode, and it tells so much about Harry's character. So Keith confides that he just says, "I'm a scam artist." And then he lays into Harry. He says, Like, he first says, you really did all that stuff. And then he says, I'm a scam artist, just like you, but you're worse. At least what I do makes people feel good. And when Harry starts to, like, laugh that off, he just bites into him. Like, Keith yells and says, what are you laughing at? Stop being a dick, Harry. And, like, that's something that he needs to hear. Like, that is so great. Like, I love that scene. It's just so just straightforward. Like, it just cuts him down. And he talks about how Keith yells at him and says, you can't just shove a gun into someone's face because you want money. That's a person, and now everybody you walk by, you treat like a husk you can slip into like a cheap hotel robe. I love that. He's just tearing into him, and like, that's what this character needs, because he's so selfish and self-involved and everything. He sees this weird supernatural situation that he's in as an opportunity to get what he needs and get what he can out of people and situations and everything. Like, he doesn't have any intention of giving back John's body because he sees it as an escape. And that is just abhorrent in the grand scheme of things, because he has no concept of what that means for the actual, like, consciousness of John, who is now inhabiting his body, Harry's body. And then Keith goes on to say, and worst of all, for all that talk about Mirena, you treat her like a problem that needs solving. And again, this is the moral center of the entire episode, and the kind of the big emotional and moral center of the episode. It all hangs in the balance hangs on the question of how Harry is going to take this information. How is it going to change him? Is it going to change him for the better, or is he not going to listen to it the same way that he wouldn't listen to Mirena when they were arguing in the apartment? So that's kind of the big question at this point in the episode. And then Keith kicks him out because he doesn't want to be involved in any of this or anything. He doesn't want, like, he needs to go. He needs to get out. So he kicks him out, but the money's still inside. And that's something that I find interesting. Like, the money is never resolved. Like, nothing, we don't know what happens to the money. It's very easy to just presume that Keith took the money and everything. And that also pays off really well. The line from the woman passing on the street saying, like, he just wants your money. He gets the money. I kind of appreciate that. But also, with Keith being such an empathetic person, I wonder if he would return the money or if he would keep it. That's something that's not resolved at all. My thinking is that he would probably return the money. Yeah. But one could argue that Harry doesn't really need the money at this point. He doesn't end up needing the money since he becomes Reese at the end and has a second chance with Mirena, which is something I'll talk through at the end of this episode, because that's a pretty complex situation. So then we transition to night, and Harry inhabiting John's body is filing a police report, about the missing bag. And they get immediately suspicious because he is very distracted. He's like, he says, like, oh, I left a bag in there and I can't get it back. And they're like, well, why can't you wait until the morning? And he's like, well, there are important documents and stuff. And they're very suspicious and everything. And then one of them walks away, and you hear her talk to the radio. She says, like, well, he matches the description. So she comes back and they ask his name, and he doesn't remember his name. And then they ask if he was at the coffee shop earlier in the day, and he immediately says, yes, well, no. And it's just like, he's so bad at this. Like, he's really, really, really bad at this. And I really liked this piece of kind of levity, but also this cornered animal kind of dynamic in this part of the episode. And that's when we get our rapid swap moment. So he sees this kind of punk rock guy standing by this on the sidewalk a ways away, and he yells, hey, Sex Pistols. And he looks up and they swap bodies. And then I like that it shows that he can swap at a distance, but I like that it just goes immediately from the punk guy to the woman across the street. And then he sees Mr. Martinez, the older man, and he yells for him. And then he swaps over into his body. It's just rapid fire. And I kind of wonder, cause I'm jumping in just a little bit ahead. Like, if he can swap from across a street, it's maybe a little weird that he can't do it to someone in glasses, but I guess it's fine because the camera just can't focus on the eyes when we see the woman's eyes when he tries to jump into her. So in the kind of vestibule of the apartment building, there's a conversation that takes place between Martinez and the mom and son, with Harry being in Martinez's body. And I like that she asks, like, oh, hey, how's it going? Or what are you doing? And he's just like, just chilling. Again, I love those little bits of dialogue that don't belong in the body that he's inhabiting. So, at this moment, like, I just want to mention, this kid is so annoying. Like, nothing against the actor. Like, he does a great job, in the episode overall. But the actual, like, him tugging on her arm and, like, whining about going upstairs is, like, I mean, I know how that goes. I know how that feels from when I was a kid. But man, seeing that as an adult, that's just so annoying. But, I don't know. And it pays off later in a good way. So Harry, as Mr. Martinez, being confused about where he lives and everything, elicits this sense of concern in the woman and is the most convincing Harry is while he's in someone else's body. Like this plays really well for his situation. And then he attempts to swap into her body, which is a little bit disturbing. Well, obviously all of this is disturbing, but it's weird that, I don't know, it just makes me uncomfortable that, like, okay, he was gonna try to swap into her body, and then, like, he's gonna be stuck with a kid, and it's just gonna be, I can't imagine how awkward that would have been. So, but he's denied because she's wearing glasses, and when you see him try to look her in the eye, the camera kind of tries to, the screen focuses on her glasses and eyes. So it's like, he can't do it. And then that tracks fine enough. That's fine. So then his consolation prize is that he swaps into Miles the kid. And, when that happens, when he jumps into the kid, I got very nervous. Like, I got very nervous that he was going to do something dangerous regarding the skylight. Like, I thought it was, like, for some reason, I had this sensation. I thought that he was going to get into a position where the episode was going to show us that he has so little regard for other people that he doesn't care if he endangers this kid that he's inhabiting. Fortunately, it doesn't get that dark. He just kind of rappels down into the shop and, looks for the bag. But let me back up a little bit because I haven't gotten there yet. So we get a shot in the car with Reese and Ethan Embry at, like, Harry's body, and Miles's consciousness is inhabiting Harry's body. And my God, like, this is maybe my favorite part of Ethan Embry's performance here, because he is playing up the frightened, just out of this world, terrified child so spectacularly well. Like, the moment where, like, he's kind of, like, weeping uncontrollably, and, like, when Reese is trying to reassure him and, like, asks his name and everything, he says everything's gonna be okay. The way that Ethan Embry as Miles says okay, like, it's just like, it is so like, authentic to that feeling of, like, this hysterical child who is, like, terrified and in tears, like, hysterically crying, and then trying to be, like trying to acknowledge the reassurance that he's been given by the only adult that's near him. I really loved Ethan Embry's performance here. So, while he's being hysterical and everything, I like that Reese gets another call from Morena, and what I like about that is that this kind of irony that Harry is talking throughout this entire scene, and he's screaming and everything, but there's no way that, for as much effort as Harry's consciousness has tried to, like, work on his voice and try to be, like, try to have a voice and to convince her that he's him, the one moment where Morena is talking, or is it within earshot of Harry's body, Harry is inhabited by a kid and screaming bloody murder just about. And so there's no way that Morena would ever recognize Harry's voice in that situation. I love that kind of playful irony that takes place in this scene. And then when Reese hangs up the phone, I also love the way that Reese diffuses the situation, or tries to diffuse the situation. He's just like, "Hey buddy, do you like ice cream?" And even Embryo's Miles is just like, "Yeah." Just really, really good. I really enjoyed that bit in the episode. So then we get back into the apartment with the mother and son, and it's bedtime. And I want to single out the toys in the scene when, like, the camera starts on the bedside table of the kid and pans over to the bed. There are toys on the bedside table. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that the toys are the same toys are from the original replicas of the original series. I think that it's original series Easter eggs, because I think that they look familiar. They look kind of similar to the toys that Lou Bookman had in One for the Angels that he sold to the kids in the neighborhood. The second episode of The Twilight Zone. So I think that that's a reference to that, but I can't confirm. But I'm like 99% sure. So I like seeing Harry, like the consciousness of Harry trying to be this child persona. And this is where the actor playing Miles, Miles Foley is his name, does such a great job, because he's being overly sweet, and it's played up with so much comedy, because he's an adult man and he's trying to like be convincing as a child. And it's really great. Like, this whole episode's about an actor trying to act. And I love how he's like kind of workshopping this performance in this moment. And like he recognizes like he needs to do more, because when she asks like what book he once read to him, he's just like, "Whatever." And she's like, "What?" And then she starts reading Little Red Riding Hood, which I thought was very apropos to the scene and to the concept of the episode, because obviously it's about a wolf in the grandmother's clothes and everything. I thought that was a nice subtle touch. And then with it, like, even before she even finishes the first sentence of the book, Harry as Miles is like, "Okay, I'm done. I need to go to bed." And she's like, "Well, we haven't even started." And then like this line made me laugh quite a bit when he's like, "I want to go to sleep and dream about you." Because again, it's just this overly affectionate and overly sweet, depiction. And like, she's like, "Okay." And then she walks away, and then she stops and she's like, "Are you feeling okay?" I just love the confusion there. It's an extension of the confusion between Jill and Belinda earlier in the episode. And I like that they don't go too far with these things, these interactions. They just exist. It's a very well-paced, episode, in my opinion. So immediately when the mother leaves the room, Harry as Miles goes to the skylight, and he gets into the psychic shop. There's not much there, in terms of his traversing into the psychic shop. Like, we don't see him getting into the skylight, but it's fine. I'm fine with the suspension of disbelief. We're like, we got the sheets tied, leading to the skylight. So I bought it. But the money's gone. He can't find the bag anywhere. And just then the flashlight trains on him, and Harry and Reese are there. And I love this final confrontation. First of all, Harry's body with Miles's mind is like, "That's me." And I love the kind of genuine confusion that is evoked when Reese asks Miles as Harry, or Harry as Miles, "How are you doing this?" And Harry just responds, just matter of fact, like, "I don't know." And I think that is just so beautiful. Like, it's so succinct and to the point, and it doesn't ask too many questions or do anything. It's just an ambiguous, circumstance that's happening. So Reese asks him to switch back, and he's being very diplomatic in diffusing of the situation. He says, "You'll only get 5 years and probably serve less than that with good behavior and everything." And, I like that Reese tells him to do the right thing. Like, this is his moment. This is Harry's moment. It's the moment where we will find out whether the Twilight Zone made him realize his problems and made him grow as a result of that, or if this would go a different way for him. And we get that pretty immediately. So he goes to Harry's body and he is going to switch. And I really, before the final swap, I just want to mention that the line that Reese says, where he says, "Harry, you have to give this little boy his body back." Out of context, that is such a bizarre line. I don't know. I have no further observation about that. I just think that that is just such a bizarre line and, just really, really out there. So Harry, as Miles, goes up to Harry's body. And he's like gearing up and psyching himself up to do the final swap. And I could kind of see it coming, but that doesn't detract from it. Figured that he was probably going to swap into Reese's body. And the conference, and that's what he does. I like the line, like, but I don't want my body. And then he looks at Reese, and then that's when it happens. And the confrontation that ensues is really cool and really intense. Like, Miles is screaming throughout it because he's back in his body, and it pays off that annoying scene earlier with the mother and him pulling in everything. And I really like the line where he says, "Which one is the bad guy here?" I just thought that was a really cool line. And then, Reese in Harry's body, threatens Harry in Reese's body, and like they go back and forth. They're like, "Well, what are you going to do?" And then he's like, "I'll take you back to the station and go Clockwork Orange on your ass." And so, okay. So I mentioned earlier that I, misinterpreted Gillian Jacobs' look in the last episode at the end as a Norman Bates homage from Psycho. But I think I misinterpreted it because I think it was more a Kubrick stare from really any Kubrick movie. And I kind of wonder with that realization at the end of Meet in the Middle and with this reference to Clockwork Orange, and then also in the trailer for the season, in one episode, we see just a close-up shot of a HAL 9000 replica from 2001, A Space Odyssey, like that kind of rectangular thing with the red eye. I kind of wonder if there is going to be a Kubrick reference in every episode, and maybe that's the kind of running theme throughout the episode or throughout the season, much like the 10-15, like the thing that everyone's going to be looking for each episode. That could be a little bit more niche than just a number, but I'm kind of curious if how much Kubrick references we're going to get this season. So, at the height of their confrontation, Reese as Harry pulls the gun, and then, Harry as Reese pulls the gun, and then Reese as Harry gets it back because obviously Harry is not a trained, professional with a sidearm. And then that's when the cops come in and they shoot Reese, who has Harry in his mind. And so this is a pretty dark ending, for the character of Reese, obviously. Presumably he's now dead. clearly he's now dead. And then the kind of, final scene, or one of the final scenes, the penultimate scene, is Harry as Reese comes home. And I like that in that, like before that, in that final showdown, there's a line where Harry, as Reese, says, like he mentions that he can convince Morena that he's, meaning that he can convince her that he's Harry. And like, that just seems kind of, I don't know, it just seems, like, again, he's just looking for an escape. He's looking to escape his problems. He's looking to not be responsible. He's not willing to put in the work or face the consequences of his actions because he thinks that he is above that level of culpability. And that just shows that he hasn't really grown from this experience in the Twilight Zone. And then he gets another surprise. So he knocks on the door and Morena just lets him in. And this is where he discovers that Reese has been sleeping with Morena. And I just gotta say, how sad for Morena. Like on one hand, she's stuck with the same man, inhabiting the body of the man that she loves, who has presumably been good to her. without knowing that he is really dead. And on the other hand, well, I don't think so. I was going to say, on the other hand, Harry may have turned over a new leaf, but he hasn't. Like, he's just, the only thing that he's grown from this, we'll see from the epilogue scene, is that he's learned how to be a better actor, which is pretty disturbing in my opinion. So then we get kind of the final scene of it before the narration. We get a recursion of the audition scene with, Harry now embodying Reese's body. And, we get like the song playing as I've Got You Under My Skin. This version of it is performed by Shirley Bassey. And so Reese's body, Harry's mind, is super successful in the audition. And he mentions, like, I think of it as slipping on a bathrobe, which I thought was a nice callback to Keith's, like, tongue lashing that he gave to Harry. And really, what does this say about Harry's transformation? He's more confident and he's discovered a version of empathy, but I don't know, what lesson does that leave us with? I'm not really sure on that. So he ends it with saying, like, I was just being me. I was just being myself when they congratulate him and how great he is. And they offer him to read for the lead role in the project. And so there's a dark read of this that where you can say that Harry didn't learn anything about himself. So instead, the lesson he learned was, like I said, how to become a better actor. But there's nothing to say that he doesn't take that lesson home to Mirena also. But if you allow me to nitpick a little bit, the Mirena and Harry / Reese relationship is just flat out not sustainable. Like, Mirena has to find out that he's really Harry. Or at the very least, she's going to be notified that Harry is dead, and she'll surely find out that somehow that Reese was there. And maybe this could be a situation where a thought experiment arises where you think that, okay, well, he's going to just gaslight her into making it all better and everything. I don't know. Yeah, that's the episode. We get the closing narration from Jordan Peele. I'm going to go ahead and play a clip of that here.
Harry Pine took a dangerous risk. One that cost him his body and his soul. But, in a way, he caught the big break he was waiting for. For better or worse, he'll have plenty of time to practice for this performance. If you're looking for Harry Pine, you'll find him starring in the role of a lifetime on a show that will run forever. Here. In the Twilight Zone.
So, another solid closing narration. I like that it's focused on the performance of Harry Pine, like his role as an actor and everything. I like it. I don't know that he got any kind of comeuppance, but I also don't think that he grew or achieved anything except for success, which is material, and he's just kind of feeding into his egotistical lifestyle. So it's kind of a bleak ending, but not necessarily as bleak as last time as Meet in the Middle. Of course, with the closing narration, we do get a close-up shot of the camcorder, and it is the Whipple brand, and it's most likely the same camera from Replay last year. Not that they're in the same universe or anything, but kind of interesting. So that is the Who of You. For notes for this episode, I do want to mention something that I just really realized right now, while I was talking through it, is that it's kind of an interesting play on the kind of very dark concept of Get Out. That's revealed in kind of the third act of Get Out, where, like, this story, not that it's particularly racially motivated at all, like, there's no racial read of it or anything, but, like, in Get Out, the white people were, you know, using African Americans' bodies to inhabit mentally and everything. So this is an interesting kind of riff on that concept and everything. Not that it's racially motivated at all, but it's just an interesting concept that it's played with within the Jordan Peeleverse, I guess. But also kind of a bigger a bigger connection that can be made is that the plot of this movie, or this plot of this episode, is really similar to the 1998 supernatural thriller Fallen, starring Denzel Washington. I haven't seen Fallen, but I'm aware of it. So the plot summary, courtesy of IMDb, is homicide detective John Hobbs witnesses the execution of serial killer Edgar Reese. Soon after the execution, the killings start again, and they are very similar to Reese's style. So it's interesting that that movie is about a serial killer who comes back to life or is inhabiting the bodies of different people. So if I remember correctly from bits and pieces I saw when I was a kid, when my parents were watching it, I think it's he could touch another person and jump into their body and inhabit them. But it's really interesting that the serial killer's name is Edgar Reese. So I have to assume that that's not a coincidence and that Detective Reese is named as an Easter egg or homage to the character of, Edgar Reese in Fallen, because that's too coincidental, I think. And then really that's all of the notes that I have for this episode of The Twilight Zone. Season 2. Next up, I'm going to post this on June 30th, and then in 2 days, you will get another episode of me reviewing You Might Also Like, which I'm very excited to check out. It's an episode that's written and directed by Osgood Perkins, and for the Patreon recording, I'm going to talk about my feelings about his movie, I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. His movie from 2016, that he wrote and directed. And that is available on Netflix. So if you are on Patreon, go ahead and support me on Patreon, patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. And I'll share my thoughts on that movie on Patreon. And then, so let me know what you guys thought of this episode of The Twilight Zone and this episode of Anthology. We're in it. This is the season. This is season 2 of the new Twilight Zone. So let me know what you thought, what you're thinking of the TV show this season. And, you know where to find me. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for supporting me and listening and everything. And I'll see you next time. And now, here's a short clip from our Patreon-exclusive RSS feed. To hear the full clip and more exclusive Patreon content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and become a patron at the minimum rate of $1 per month. Thank you and enjoy! Above all else, the thing that I love most about Keanu is the freaking cat. And I have to be careful because Pete's sitting right next to me. But I've got to say, I really think that Keanu has the cutest use of a cat in any movie I've ever seen. That cat is freaking adorable. And
Anthology is edited and produced by Matt Hurt and presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For a full archive of our episodes, go to anthologypod.com/archive. You can also like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod and follow the show on Twitter at OVAnthologyPod. If you enjoy the show, please take a couple minutes to leave us a rating and a quick review on Apple Podcasts. This is the easiest way to support what we do, and all it costs is a little bit of your time. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, you can make a PayPal donation at anthologypod.com/donate, or support us on Patreon for recurring donations and access to commentary tracks and B-roll audio recorded exclusively for patrons at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Every donation goes toward paying the fees to keep the podcast running and is greatly appreciated. Official Anthology merch, including shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more, can be found in the Obsessive Viewers TeePublic store. You can find a link to the store in the show notes of this episode and at anthologypod.com/donate. Or you can simply search for Obsessive Viewer at teepublic.com. For information about the Obsessive Viewer's annual live event showcasing short horror films from local filmmakers, check out shocktoberinirvington.com. And for an archive of all our events, as well as news about potential future events, head over to obsessiveviewer.com/live. For more podcast content, you can find our flagship movie and TV review and discussion show, The Obsessive Viewer Podcast, at obsessiveviewer.com and on Twitter at obsessiveviewer. You can also find Tower Junkies, a podcast where Matt and co-host Tiny share their love of all things Stephen King and his magnum opus, The Dark Tower series, over at TowerJunkiesPod.com and at TowerJunkiesPod on Twitter. And finally, check out The Secular Perspective, Tiny's side project podcast, which tackles current events and life's big questions from the perspective of secular hosts Chad and Amanda at TheSecularPerspective.com. Bumper music for this podcast comes courtesy of As Good As It Gets, which can be found at facebook.com/asgoodasitgetsband. You can also find As Good As It Gets music on Spotify, Google Play, and iTunes. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Kitty!
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.